This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. The land on which I am lucky enough to raise my son always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This episode of Ready or Not is brought to you by Ready or Not. You can shop our go-to guides now at readyornot.au.
My motherhood is not just rage. It's just this one little piece of my existence. I had to get moms to talk to me about this thing that people both want to talk about and don't want to talk about. One mom wrote to me about how she used to scream underwater. The societal neglect of mothers is affecting all of us. Our rage actually contains a lot of wisdom. When's the last time I ate, slept, had sex, exercised, saw friends? Because as mothers, we're supposed to actually not have any needs.
When Minna Dubin wrote about mum rage for the New York Times, her words went viral. In opening the article, she writes, "The rage lives in my hands, rolls down my fingers, clenching to fists. I want to hurt someone. I am tears and fury and violence. I want to scream and rip open pillows, toss chairs and punch walls. I want to see my destruction, feathers floating, overturned furniture, ragged holes in dry wall." Even recording this now, I'm nervous to admit that I resonated with this so deeply that it nearly moved me to tears. It feels somewhat unsafe to confess that motherhood can drive me to a type of fury I've never known until now, but that's the entire point. Was she nervous about putting her name to something that many would describe as volatile, negative, even violent? Yes, she was. But she did it anyway, and when she did, the stories came pouring in. Here, we talk the universality of mum rage, the shame attached to it, how she's made work as a mother of two, and why we all need to take our mum rage out to tea. I'm Lucinda. This is Ready or Not. That's Posy, if you can hear. And here is the clever and candid Minna Dubin. Minna, when and where did you first hear the term mum rage?
So I'm not 100% sure, but I think that I first heard the term mother rage. I heard that first in Anne Lamott's 1998 essay that was in Salon, that was called Mother Rage Theory and Practice. And her essay kind of gave me the confidence that like this was a thing and I could talk about it. And then after I published the piece, The Rage Mothers Don't Talk About in the New York Times, a bunch of different people were like, "Oh, do you know the podcast Mom Rage?" And there was a podcast that was called that. And it was by these two writers, Eden Lapucky and Amelia Morris. And the podcast wasn't about mom rage. Not really, but I really liked that podcast. And so, you know, I listened to it all the time and the opening starts with like a kid like screaming mom rage, like the words being like mom rage or something like that. So I think that, you know, that phrase really got into my head. And so somewhere between when I wrote that essay that used the word mother rage and listening to this podcast, I changed it to mom rage.
And we will get into that piece that went viral and led to all sorts of stories and solidarity from readers far and wide. But before we do, let's talk about your career before motherhood. What were you up to?
Before motherhood, I was a teaching artist. Are you familiar with that?
I don't think I am. Tell me anyway. I'm making assumptions, but I'd love to know.
It's more of a phrase that people know now, but back when I was like trying to become a teaching artist after I finished college in, you know, 2003, just to age myself, you know, the idea was I wanted to be the guest artist. I wanted to be the writer that showed up in English class or like an after school program or like a teen's library program at like 4 p.m. And to run creative writing workshops for teens about identity. I was interested in race and class and gender and sexuality and how those things kind of affect our experience in the world. So I did that basically. I made my dreams come true more or less through like a variety of experiences in school. And I taught creative writing workshops for teens around that. And often they would be they had a performance element. So at the end, we would do like a performance of our pieces, or we would like turn them into a little book. So I was basically like a guest artist was my
Amazing. So
career.
was that a freelance sort of capacity or?
Yeah, it was freelance. There are a few organizations around, maybe more than a few, I'm not sure, around the country, that hire teaching artists and then put them in locations. So this one is now defunct, but there used to be one that was part of the San Francisco Arts Commission that was around for like 17 years called Writers Corps. And so I worked at a high school for pregnant teens.
Oh, wow.
And then I worked at the main library in San Francisco. Those were my two locations that I worked at for years.
Oh, wow. What was that experience like working with pregnant teens when you weren't yet, I guess, on the trajectory of motherhood yet?
Yeah, it was before. I mean, I loved it. And I had worked with that population before in Kentucky at a home for pregnant teens. So I loved that population. I think teenagers are just kind of my people, like teenagers in general. Like, I'm very excited for my kids to become teens. I feel like that's going to be my motherhood sweet spot. I hope so anyway. But yeah, I loved it. I loved how they were sort of like in this like in between period of like not quite kid, not quite adult, but they had this complication of being mothers, and like it was just like so messy. I think I felt like they had so much to say, so much to write about.
And so you're working with a lot of kids of all ages. You're working with pregnancy in some capacity. How do you feel about motherhood yourself before the idea of having kids, I guess, started to take place for you?
It's a little embarrassing, but I didn't really think that much about motherhood.
Oh, I think that's great. Some of us spend way too much time thinking about
I mean,
it.
I knew I always wanted kids. Like, I had never questioned that. It was just sort of assumed. And I think for many women, it feels like that. You're just like, well, of course I'm going to get married and have kids. So I was definitely on that trajectory of like, well, yeah, that's what I want. But I didn't really think critically about it very much. Yeah, it just happened. And I met my now husband and father of my children when I was 22
Oh,
and got
wow.
married at 27 and had my first kid at 31. So it was all like relatively early. Yeah, so I did not think about being a mother or what that would mean. I just did it. I
That
just
was
wanted a
almost the
baby.
ex yeah, that was almost the exact same timeline as me now that you say that. How funny.
Oh,
How did you feel about it from that career point of view? Did you see the way your career would be able to merge with motherhood, or did it stress you out? Or if you weren't thinking about it too much, maybe that was another area that you just were going to let play out.
More of that. I never considered like what the stress of motherhood might be. I never even thought of the phrase motherhood stress. Like, none of it occurred to me. Yeah, I knew nothing of motherhood and had I don't know, my career wasn't very thought out. Like, and the career that I've just described to you, like it was pretty chill. And it was all on like, a yearly contractual basis. So it was like I had to hustle as a teaching artist, but it was also flexible. So it was sort of perfect, I thought, for a mom. Yeah, I don't know. And I had this luxury, I guess, to not think about how motherhood would affect my career as a teaching artist because I was marrying a guy who was in medical school. So I was like, well, he's going to make enough money. Like, I can just be a teaching artist, which would have been really hard to live as a parent off of a teaching artist salary because you don't make that much as like, doing gig work.
That's so true. It's like less
Yeah.
pressure of the actual earnings and more just
Yeah.
about filling your passions. So
Right.
then you do eventually fall pregnant. How does that go with you alongside your paid work? Did you feel okay? Were you sick as a dog? Were you somewhere in between?
I was mostly okay. I was one of those annoying people who like kind of loved being pregnant. I think part of it was that I really wanted to be pregnant and I really loved being pregnant. I also liked the social experience of being pregnant. I mean, I didn't love people touching my belly when I didn't ask them to, but
Oh,
like for the
yeah.
most part, I did like it. I loved being pregnant for my job. Like, I loved being pregnant with the girls. And it made me realize like that I thought I understood them before, but I didn't. Like getting to be pregnant and going to work with them was so cool. And I didn't like the only thing about it is that is like maternity leave because I was on, you know, I was a freelancer. I didn't have any maternity leave.
And so what did that look like for you? Because I think is the stat that 1 in 4 Americans go back to work 2 weeks after their babies
Within
are born?
2 weeks. Yeah. I was lucky in that my first kid was born right before the winter break. So, you know, his birthday is December 17th. And so I worked until the last day, basically, and then had him, had 2 weeks off, or maybe it was 3 weeks or something. I think it was 2 weeks. And then my boss, who was just very nice, and I asked her if I could take a month. So I got 4 more weeks. So I got 6 weeks, which for America is like not so bad. And
Isn't
then
that
I
incredible?
marched my little still bleeding self back to work with him in a carrier.
Wow.
And I took him with me. They said I could take him, you know?
And so what was that like? Because in some ways, newborns can be easy. That's not everyone's experience, obviously, but they sleep a lot. You can strap them to your chest. But at the same time, you've just completed this humongous task of growing, birthing, and potentially now feeding a baby. What was that like returning to work at 6 weeks postpartum?
It was kind of a whirlwind. I mean, I feel like I was still kind of on an adrenaline rush in a way. Like I was so excited to bring him to work. I was so excited to be a mom with my students. Like that just felt like I wanted that experience so badly. And it made me realize like how unforgiving I had been of them, like how, what high standards I had held them to. Like when they were tired, I was not that forgiving. You know, I was like, do the writing work. And then I had this baby and I was like, oh God, I was so like not understanding. And now I totally get it. I don't know. It was mostly okay bringing him. I was both tired, but I loved my work. And we were doing this huge show in May. So the next like 4 months of me having him, I was just working my butt off. Like it was probably one of the hardest things besides writing this book I've ever done was those 4 months of having him and working with the girls.
And did childcare come into play at all during that time? Or was it really just working with him by your side?
My mother-in-law lives in the area. And so she would come either 1 or 2 days. One day I had a meeting and so I couldn't bring him to the like adult staff meeting. And I think she would come another day. So she came some and definitely helped out, which was great.
And what about your motherhood experience in those early days outside of Korea? What do you reflect on most when you look back to that period?
I was very, very sleep deprived. When I look back on that period, like I think about how much I was obsessed with my baby sleeping and me sleeping and how nobody was sleeping well and how distraught I was. It was like, that was a big form of like of distress for me. But also like how very delicious it was to have his body on my body all the time, which is what it seemed like he needed. I was like, he slept on my body. Like I would lie on my back and we would sleep tummy to tummy for a long time. Cause that's the only way he would sleep. It was both like horrible and so sweet, you know?
Whenever my son demands a lot of me, I'm like, this is heaven and hell all at the same time. So I totally resonate with that. So what point does your writing then start to turn to motherhood? You're becoming pretty well known, obviously, especially with the publishing of your book, Mum Rage. Mm-hmm. When do you think you started to really explore that and pitch writing ideas on the subject of motherhood?
I think it began, so for the, well, my writing has always been about identity. Like before I was a mother, I was writing about race and class and gender and sexuality and basically how those things were affecting my interpersonal relationships, like the invisible things that were happening underneath the surface, which I feel like Mom Rage, that book is also about the invisible things that are happening underneath the surface. Like, I'm still sort of doing the same work I've always been doing. It's just changed a little bit. So I basically stopped writing when I had my son, and then for the final show with the pregnant and parenting teens I was working with, they did this show called Iron Mom that we put on, and I opened for them for the show. And I opened for them with a monologue about the 4 month sleep regression.
Oh, do you have that on tape? Could I see that somewhere? On tape, how am I? It's the 90s.
It's probably on YouTube, actually. I'll see if I can send it to
Oh,
you.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah. And in that piece, he wakes me up for the thousandth time. I write about it in the book, actually. And I like punch the mattress, and my husband says to me, "What do you need?" It's the middle of the night, and I say, "I need to not be his mother." And the whole room in the audience gasps. Like, there's this collective gasp when I say that line. And then, I end the piece, and like it's very tearful and beautiful. And in the morning, he's all gummy smiles, and I'm like so grateful that I didn't like my the terrible thing I said didn't like have bad karma, and like he wasn't, I don't know. I just it was so intense. Anyway, and that was really the first time that I wrote about motherhood in this public way and shared like a very dark moment. And even though, the audience gasped, lots of people came up to me and privately said to me, "That was really amazing. I remember that moment," kind of like from my own, like, it was the first time that I got that feedback from mothers, like secretly telling me, like, "Me too."
A lot of the gasps would have been like, oh, she said the thing that I want to say.
I
Not,
think
oh
so.
my God, I can't believe she feels that way. So then you do write this piece about mother rage that is published in the New York Times, and it triggers hundreds, maybe even thousands of mums to write to you about their mum rage. Firstly, tell us about piecing this together. And I guess that maybe cliff moment of publishing such a vulnerable and perhaps not widely spoken about topic. And then we'll go into after that some of the stories and the common threads that you started to find when people did write into you.
I mean, so I published that piece in what was then the New York Times parenting section, which was a new section for the New York Times, and they were looking for, for content. And one of the things that they put a call out for was the harder parts of motherhood. And I had this essay on mom rage, so I submitted it, and sort of to my shock, they accepted it. It was my first time, writing in the New York Times. And I was both absolutely thrilled because it was such a big outlet, and also extremely terrified because of the content of the essay, because it was such a kind of vulnerable and tender and shame. Like, I felt, there's still shame around mom rage. Like, it felt, I was just scared. I was scared to put it out in public. And did a lot of work to kind of try and scrub all my information and my family's names from the internet and anything I'd previously published. And
Did you know it
yeah.
would go viral before you keep going? Sorry.
I mean, never in my wildest dreams would I imagine that anything I would write would go viral.
And so what stories stand out to you the most that you started to receive just after pressing go live on that piece?
I mean, I don't know that there one or two of the stories actually made it into the book. There was one woman who talked about how she used to, people respond to mom rage by telling me their mom rage stories. And so one mom wrote to me about how she used to scream underwater at the public pool. She would go lap swim, and that the
That actually
pandemic,
sounds like a great idea. Like, I'm
it's
not
a
even
great
joking. That's
idea.
such a good idea. What a release.
I know, but the pandemic took that from her, is what she wrote.
Ah, that's really
Well,
interesting.
maybe she wrote me that, once the pandemic started, I guess. Someone else talked about like biting down on her ch on like the fluffy, like fake fur hood of like her child's onesie as she's holding her child, so as not to hurt her child, but just like feeling like she's going to go crazy. I just remember, like, and I wrote that one in the book. Like, there were some that were so like visual. I could just picture them happening.
Yes.
And you know, one or two ended up being amazing stories. Like, you know, I've now like looked to create my own mom support group, and there's eight of us meeting every week. Like one or two like people ended up taking action after reading that piece and trying, and probably more, but only one or two, you know, wrote to me about it, trying to get themselves more, you know, support from other moms, which I thought was really beautiful.
And did you get much backlash? Was there the opposite? Was there any sense of, I guess, hate mail or like we just got on with it or any of that sort of narrative?
There was not a ton. Yeah, that's what, right, that's what I was so afraid of, sort of. I definitely have gotten a few nasty emails over the last few years. You know, mostly saying that I'm mentally ill, that I shouldn't be a mother, that they feel sorry for my children. Just like not nice emails, but I feel like there was no way I was going to write about this topic and not get those emails. Like I
Yeah.
feel that was expected. People feel
Yeah.
very people have very strong feelings about what mothers are supposed to say and what mothers are supposed to be like. And I was saying this thing that you're absolutely not supposed to be like and you're not supposed to say. So those few emails were like, I mean, really, it was like 1%. And
Yeah.
99% was mothers like crying in relief from me naming this thing that they didn't know wasn't just their horribleness.
Yeah. So then how did you prepare, I guess, for that potential backlash? Obviously, it didn't form too much of the narrative, which is great, but just thinking for someone like me who likes to talk about the stickier parts of motherhood too, did you coach yourself through how to respond to the negativity, or do you just think that's your approach to life, just to take the good and not focus too much on the bad?
You know, I've been in writing groups with other writers who publish like in the, you know, out in the world. And so I've heard them say over and over in different writing groups, don't read the comment section. So, you know, the worst of it was on New York Times Twitter, you know, the
Oh, of
comments on
course.
their Twitter
Of
when they
course.
posted the article. So, you know, I think I read a little bit and like saw how nasty some of the comments were, and I just stopped reading because it's not helpful. And I just delete the emails. The minute I see it's gonna be mean. I mean, sometimes I don't have the willpower and I'll read the entire thing and then delete it, but sometimes I just like see the start of it and delete it.
I think that's good advice.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing you can do. Like, people are going to be crazy and people are going to be mean, and they're not able to step outside of their tiny box of experience. And I can't help them with that.
And so then you've just recently published Mum Rage. When does the idea of a book start to germinate and how does that process develop? Is it a publisher coming to you? Is it you pitching?
So I wrote that first piece in 2019 in September, and then it got republished in 2020 in April, right after the pandemic hit. They republished it. And then around that time, I started getting all these emails, and I was like, I think that the pandemic has spurred mom rage more, like has made it worse. Of course it did, right?
Oh, yeah. I wasn't a mum yet, but I look back now at my friends that were, and I think, wow, what a big time that must have been.
Yeah, no, totally. And so I wrote a second piece for the New York Times that was published in July 2020, that first summer of the pandemic, that was specifically about mom rage in a pandemic. And that piece also went viral. And at that point, that summer, agents started reaching out to me,
Wow.
asking me if I, you know, if I was writing a book on mom rage.
Speaking of mum rage, a quick break to talk about our go-to guides. I can tell you from experience that if you adopt some of the strategies and use some of the checklists supplied in our postpartum and return to work planning go-to guide, such as what to do 3 months before returning to paid work, how to identify your support network, and the conversations to have with your partner, you'll help to alleviate the anger that can come with feeling touched out, feeling as though your partner doesn't understand you, and so much more. I must admit, when we started making these go-to guides, I was so nervous about making these as valuable as possible. And I'm quite floored by the result. Each created with an expert in their field, they're really practical, beautiful, readable, actionable. I can't believe the result. We're so proud of them. And you can shop the collection now at readyornot.au.
And of course, I was not writing a book on mom rage. but I didn't know if I wanted to write a book on mom rage. Yeah. You know, I mean, my motherhood is not just rage.
Yes.
Like, it's just this one little piece of my existence. So I was also afraid, sort of. I was like, is this the book that I want to have my name on?
That's a really interesting point, because even with a lot of the podcast interviews and topics that I run, I'm so aware of it not just being too negative. There's this need to talk about the hard bits of motherhood, and we all deserve that. But you also don't want to brand yourself as just being negative all the time. It's really tricky.
Yeah. And people, you know, people hate a negative mother.
Yeah.
You know, I felt afraid, kind of, but I also felt like this topic needed a book. And like, if someone was going to, and I really didn't want someone else to do it.
Yes.
Maybe that's not the best reason to write a book, because I would.
It's pretty good reason. Pretty good reason. It's a pretty good ammo to get it down on paper.
Yeah, no, I was just like, someone's going to write this book eventually, and I think it should be me. And so
I think it should be you too, because it's a great book.
But to answer your question, we did pitch it. So I picked an agent, and we did pitch it to different publishers, and then one of them bought it.
And so what happens next? I think you're a mother of two at this time. So you're navigating motherhood alongside getting something down that requires obviously a lot of logistics, but writing about mum rage must have been really emotional, because you're trying to get stories that people are willing to share. Mm-hmm. And then there's so much emotion around that. And I guess perhaps managing people's nerves around what they're willing to share and what they're not willing to share. Tell us about all of that.
Yeah. I mean, writing the book in general, writing the proposal was particularly tricky, because it was during the fall of 2020 and my kids were still not in school. And so it was just, I had no time, and I was just constantly like holed up in my room when I had like the 1 hour to myself. And it was very intense. And that proposal was 80 pages. It was like a humongous proposal. So writing it, once I got the deal, which wasn't till like May 2021 and my kids were back in school, so I had some more space, which was nice. But I had to get moms to talk to me about this thing that people both want to talk about and don't want to talk about. Like, I think we do, but it's still very challenging to really talk about it. Like, we'll talk about it sort of like around it, and we'll talk about how motherhood is hard. But when I say, can you describe what your rage sounds like? What are the words that you say? What do you do with your body? How loud is your voice? Like, when I really want someone to take me into the rage, they get really quiet.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point, because for me, like, I say to my friends, it's almost like those cartoons where like the top of your head turns into flames. Like, that's how I'd almost describe how I feel. But putting that down to your name is quite a big thing, because you're saying basically that you're going absolutely mad around the people that you love the most.
Right. And like all the moms in my book, I use pseudonyms for everybody, right? So I didn't use anybody's real name.
Yeah.
But it's still hard. It's like working an inactive muscle to like talk about this thing that we never talk about. It's hard to do. And so I really had to, we often wouldn't get to the actual rage itself till like the last 15 minutes of the episode or of the interview. And, they would talk around it, and then it would get like kind of quiet, you know, and I could tell it was hard for them to talk about.
And how did you find these mums? Was it from this sort of Rolodex that you'd built up from how many people you'd heard from after publishing these articles?
Some of them, I reached out to some of the people who had reached out to me, like you said. And then I also just put a call out. Like, I was part of, you know, tons of writer groups that had international, you know, members from around the world. And I put a call out on social media and asked people to share with their social networks so that it would, you know, extend. I didn't want to just like interview my friends. And I also just, I really tried to find a diverse group of people, because I mean, mostly because I felt like it was investigative, and I had questions like, does this affect people of different classes? Does this affect people of different nationalities, different racial backgrounds? Like, I really didn't know. And so the interviews were incredibly important in telling me like what I needed to look at in this book. I didn't know what I was doing as I started.
And what did you find for anyone that hasn't read Mum Rage yet? What did you find when answering these questions about how class, gender, culture can come into
Yeah, I found that it doesn't matter. Not
it?
exactly. Like, I found that everyone can experience mom rage, and that, same-sex couples, it doesn't matter. And that, our circumstances might affect how the rage comes out. It might affect how we talk about it. It might affect our privilege in terms of, like, if we're allowed to talk about it without people looking down on us, or you know what I mean? Like, it's not that identity and privilege don't play a role in mom rage, but the societal neglect of mothers is affecting all of us, and patriarchy is affecting all of us. And those are the real roots of mom rage, is the way that mothers are neglected and doing most of this labor unsupported. And so that really affects all moms, regardless of background.
Yes. And someone wrote to you that they still felt shame a decade after their rage. Can you tell us a bit about that story?
Yeah, I mean, not just a decade, but I've talked to, people who are now grandmothers, who I talked to this one woman who said that she still has nightmares
Wow.
about her mom rage, and her kids are grown up and they have their own kids now, and her kids are
Yeah.
fine. Like, and she has a good relationship with her kids, and she still holds that shame, and
Wow.
it comes and haunts her in her dreams.
Which seems so wrong, doesn't it? Because it's not a reflection on a mother, it's a reflection on society and what she's missing.
Yes. Yeah. And I think the grandmother piece, like, it really touches me too, because, I've talked to some grandmothers who, they've never been at most moms, I would say, have never been asked to talk about their rage. And so, they've never told their mom rage story
Yeah.
before. And so for many of them, it's the first time they've ever told the story. And then I had one grandmother, she said after talking to me, she went and talked to her friend, also a grandmother, and she told her about her mom rage. And that friend replied with her own mom rage story. And it was the first time she had ever told it.
That's
And
powerful
so,
too, because I'm forgetting like our generation is a little bit more open and prone to talking about these things, and we're given a bit more space. But for a grandmother, that would feel even more alien than it does for us.
yeah, and I don't know, that they're all holding it in a shame place like that first lady who has the dreams, but yeah, it's interesting just that, like, we don't talk about it and that we're not asking about it.
Yeah.
I want there's so many stories. Like, we just, in this world, we have so many stories that are untold, and yeah, this is one that just feels important and I'm curious about.
And in your book, you say that diagnosing it as a condition negates men and society of their responsibility in it. Can you go a bit deeper into that for us? Because I feel like this is a very big piece, if not the entire piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. So I feel wary about pathologizing mom rage as a clinical diagnosis, like postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety, because that means that there's, like, that the cause lies purely in the woman's body, right? It's her hormones or a lack of serotonin or something. And while this might be true for some moms, because anger, it can be a symptom of postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety. And people should look into it. But if we leave mom rage as just a medical diagnosis, then we absolve society and men in particular of responsibility, because mom rage is rooted in patriarchy and the structural disempowerment of mothers. So it's about a society that's totally fine with mothers doing all of the childcare, with doing
Yeah.
double the domestic labor as fathers. The society won't take care of us by giving us the things we need, like paid family leave or universal childcare. And it just, instead of, like, when you think about the pandemic, like, If it was a society that took care of mothers and families, then schools would have been the first thing to reopen. But I don't know how it is everywhere, but in America, the first thing to reopen was bars and retail, but schools
Yes,
stayed
very
shut.
similar here.
And yeah, I just think mom rage is the result of misogyny and the societal and familial neglect of mothers, and we can't blame our fury on a chemical imbalance. It feels like
Yes.
an excuse for absolving the real problem.
And so, if you were in charge tomorrow, I feel like you've just sort of given some hints as to what you'd do. But if you were in charge tomorrow, what would be the ways that you would change structures in government, in society, to better support mothers?
Oh, I mean,
But
I would definitely
this is
put.
a question without notice, so you can have
Okay, I know. I'm ready. I'm ready.
a
I mean, I answered this question in the book, sort of. First of all, I would put a diverse group of women from all sorts of backgrounds, women and non-binary people, in charge. I would turn it into a matriarchy instead of a patriarchy. But the diverse backgrounds feel super important because women
Yes.
can also like push patriarchal ideas and, you know, that power as well. So, yeah, I think we need, you know, obviously universal childcare so that mothers have the option of childcare, like from, you know, a month or two in if they need it, all the way through kindergarten or into kindergarten. And, you know, paid family leave for all parents or caregivers, regardless of biological affiliation with the child, so that, you know, queer couples can both be the bio, you know, can both be the official parent,
Yeah.
foster parents, adoptive parents, like everybody needs paid family leave. We need maternal health care that actually is safe for all birthing people. And I think we need to change the postpartum time frame in our medical in the DSM so that we look at the postpartum time frame as being a year instead of like the 12 weeks that it's looked at, so
Yeah.
that then we can get mental health treatment for, you know, a year or longer. Because right now, all support after you have a baby, basic in America at least, basically shuts off after 12 weeks.
I feel like
So
that's just when you start to get going too.
those would be some starting places. I would have the school day and the work day end at the same time
Oh,
so
wouldn't
that
that be
mothers
good? That's only just dawned on me recently how ridiculous that is. You're like, wait
So
a
that mothers
second.
don't fill in the gap, because
Yeah.
either we are in charge of the kids, which means we have less, you know, ambitious jobs so that we can do that, or we're in charge of coordinating and scheduling and
Yes.
paying for the aftercare.
And feeling a little bit guilty for the kids that
Yeah,
get to go home and all of that sort of fun stuff.
exactly. And I would also put men in childcare. I think men need to be
Yes.
doing childcare, and childcare needs to be a professionalized job. You know, it needs to have really good benefits, really good pay, because if men get in it, it will have really good benefits and really good pay. Like that'll happen. And so we need
Yes.
to stop thinking of childcare as like a women's profession.
And it's
And
like babysitting when they're doing so much more than that. Not that there's anything wrong
exactly.
with just doing nannying, but they often
Right.
get treated as though we're just people that we fling our children to when we can't look after them, which
Right.
feels so wrong
Yes.
when they spend so much time and so much care with our children.
Yes,
Why do you
totally.
think it's so easy for society to paint women and then perhaps particularly mothers as emotional? You'll see these ridiculous fights between two men in really high positions of power, and we won't really label them as emotional, but we'll be so quick to label a mother as full of rage. Why do you think that is?
When we say that someone's getting emotional, we usually mean teary, like they're sad, not yelling. So even the phrase emotional discludes anger, as if anger isn't an emotion.
Yeah.
You know, sadness is seen as a feminine emotion. It's not allowed for men. They learn like so early that they'll be seen as less powerful or less masculine, more like a woman, God forbid, if they cry. So, as a society, we denigrate women by saying she can't handle an important thing like politics or running a company because she's too emotional, which is basically coded language for saying she's not a man.
Yeah. Oh, that's
But
so true. I've never thought of it like that.
yeah, But if she led with anger, she'd be a bitch. And we all
Yes.
saw like what happened in America when Hillary Clinton ran for president, and she wasn't all smiley and giggly, and she was deemed nasty, which is another way to say she was a bitch. And I just think men are allowed to rage, and we forgive them their anger, but really anger is a cover up for the hurt that's underneath. So I feel like we're all feeling the same feelings, but women, are their sadness, our sadness is acceptable, and men's anger is acceptable. So even though we both feel really sad underneath,
Yeah. We've
yeah,
like
it's just,
gendered
it's
the
gen
reactions to similar emotions.
yeah, we're all having the same experience, but
Yeah.
men go right to anger and women go to sadness. So when a woman goes to anger, we're like, we don't even know what to do because that's not the emotion that we're expecting to come out of a woman.
Conversely, though, if a man goes to sadness, we think, oh, how nice that he's got this sweet, gentle side to him.
Right. I mean, yes, on yes, that's true, but also I think in the greater world, he also gets put down, right?
True, that
Like,
might be through my very narrow lens, but through the world's lens, it's more probably perceived as soft on a larger scale.
exactly.
Wow, you've just rocked my world a bit. That's a really interesting analogy. So I loved this part of the book. You said the tricky thing about the causes of mum rage is that we can't see the things that cause it. In their visual absence, all we see is an angry mum. All we see is the action, then reaction. This is It almost makes me emotional. It's so well put. Can you speak to that a little bit further?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was challenging about writing this book is that my thesis is basically that, we're experiencing this thing every day, right? It's like a day-to-day individual experience. And yet there's this huge structural component to it, but the structural component is completely invisible. And so it's very easy to be like, that's not real. This is you. You have an anger problem. Right.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to, like, what I'm trying to do with the book is to reveal this, like, hidden structure of, like, so, a kid, when I say all we see is the action and a reaction. So the action is the kid refuses to put on their jacket in the winter. It's the 30th day in a row that the kid refuses to put on their jacket, right? The mom and the kid have had this argument and around trying to get the kid to put on the jacket for 30 days straight. The 30th day, the mom loses it, right? That's her reaction. All we see is a kid said no and the mom lost her cool. But underneath that, what we don't see is, the kid getting kicked out of two preschools for their quote unquote behavior. And it turns out the kid, has a neurodivergence diagnosis, and the mom has to do all the work to get him the diagnosis, get him the support that he needs. Their health insurance won't cover it. She's fighting with health insurance every day for hours. She's trying
Yeah.
to get him childcare that's going to take him and be kind to him and like support him. She hasn't been able to work because this is a full-time job. All she does is around the home. She's chauffeuring him to this appointment. You know what I mean? Like we don't see how her world has like
Yeah.
completely become this and how there's no support for her anywhere. She's doing it
Yeah.
all on her own. There's no path for like this thing that she's on, being a full-time advocate for this kid, for this thing she doesn't actually understand. Right, like
Yeah.
this has all been happening for the last 2 years, and all of it is invisible, and it's about the societal lack of support for her and for children, really. It's both, like it's a lack of support for the mom and the family.
The way you've brought that example together is incredible too, because I think the thing that a lot of us can struggle with is that if you broke down every little thing individually, they can seem silly. And even when you're saying them in your head and you're trying to explain why you feel the way you do, you're like, but that's not enough of a justification. But it's always so much more than that. It's an
Right. No.
accumulation.
Right. And then on top of that, there's the familial neglect. Like there's the way that like the husband gets to stay who he is when he becomes a father, and he gets to go off and do his work every day, and he comes home and he's like, well, why is there not dinner? Or whatever it is. You know what I mean? Like there's this
Gee, that
all the
would set
gen
off my mum rage, I'll tell you what.
I mean, there's all like the gender stuff that's happening in the home. And it's hard because it's very easy to like twist what I'm saying into she's blaming society because she yelled at her kid, when like I'm not saying that it's okay to yell at your kids. Like, we still have to figure out how to speak nicely to the people in our lives. But we also need to recognize the ways that we're not supported and the way their labor is being taken for granted, even though it services the entire society.
Yes, that's a perfect segue actually into a great article you wrote for, I think, Oprah Daily, which was how you took your mum rage out to tea. And it's an excerpt from your book. Before we wrap up, for anyone again that hasn't read your book yet, can you tell us a little bit about taking your mum rage out to tea?
Sure. Yeah. In the middle of the book, you know, I felt like I had to offer some, you know, in the house, ideas about like what we can do, right? Because like I said, we still don't want to yell at our partners or at our children, even if our fury is valid. And so I'm very much not a self-help writer. Like, I do not feel comfortable ever telling anyone what to do or how to parent. So what I did is I basically told my story of what did I do and what did some of the other moms do. And so taking your rage out to tea is about doing kind of like a mental reframe around your rage. Like, instead of looking at your rage as enemy, looking at it as friend and getting super curious about it, because our rage actually contains a lot of wisdom. And if we listen to it, we're going to learn a lot about what do we need. Because as mothers, we're supposed to actually not have any needs in our modern society. Yeah. And so taking your rage out to tea is kind of like inviting your rage in as if they're a friend and asking it questions and getting smart about what is happening with your rage. Like, when asking questions like, what are the locations that I rage in? Are there other people around? Are there specific people? Are there never any other people? Do I only rage by myself? What other factors are around? When's the last time I ate, slept, had sex, exercised, saw friends? You know, so it's sort of like it's like doing a research on yourself. And that reframe of like looking at your rage as friend is really also looking at yourself as friend, so that we don't go right into a shame spiral when we yell at someone that we love, but we actually sort of mother ourselves and we're like, okay, baby, what do you need? What's going on?
Yeah, like we would if our kids rage. I mean, sometimes we don't enjoy watching our kids rage, but you think, okay, something's not quite right. Let's try and work through it. So treating yourself with the same grace. I love that. And it's really nice to have action and thought around these conversations, because with a lot of these things, it's all well and good for us to name them and I guess bring solidarity to them. But I found that to be a really helpful way to look at it. And I've started to actually incorporate into how I look into mum rage. So I'm really grateful for that advice. Before I let you go, you've published this book. You're becoming, I would imagine, pretty well known in the space, given the pieces that you've been writing. How does making work look for you today as a mother?
I mostly write outside of my home. I still have to leave in order to get work done. So I'm, you know, I'm very extroverted. So I meet a lot of friends at cafes. That helps me to work. If I feel like this social pressure to work, if I'm surrounded by people in this way that I'm like responsible to them, even though I'm not.
I totally resonate with that.
Yeah. So that's what making work looks like. Basically, I'm going out to coffee shops and I am, I'm writing. I'm, you know, here and there I'm writing essays and then I'm starting to work on the next book. And
Ooh, very exciting. So for anyone that wants to find your work, either in the book form or just any freelance pieces that you're putting out to the world, where should they go to have a look?
Sure. Well, the book, Mom Rage, you can buy it really anywhere you buy books. And all of my published work is on my website. So it's my name, it's minnadubin.com/writing. That's where all of my work is that's been published. And I'm also on Instagram at minnadubin. So, and I'm pretty active on there. And whenever I publish stuff, I put it on there. And sometimes I publish or I post about other people publishing about mom rage. So it's kind of like a little hub for mom rage.
Excellent. I love following you on Instagram. I highly recommend our listeners do too. Thank you so much from the other side of the world chatting to me today.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
Thanks for listening to Ready or Not. If you liked the show, please tell your friends, subscribe, or write a review. You can also find us on Instagram at readyornot.pod. That's it for today. We'll see you next time.